Steven Roth is too good.
These memes all day have been killing me.
You in?
Yeah, let's do it.
You ready?
Sure.
We're in.
Let's do it.
What day is it?
Today is Saturday.
Oh, yeah. 1 week ago.
Yes.
We cheated. We didn't watch something on Sunday.
I mean, Michael.
We went out on Halloween night.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
To the outdoor, socially distanced
yard cinema of Blue Starlight.
Thank you, Blue Starlight. We love you.
Yes. And we watched. I'm sorry, guys. We are in the southern part of the States. It is 80 degrees outside, but it was like 50 when we went.
It was chilly, but that didn't stop the bugs from biting my ankles hardcore.
Which they did not bite myself or Lindsay.
Look at this. This is a week later. You can't even see her face. She is gagged.
Michael, what the fuck bit you?
That's why I asked you. I think something might have laid eggs underneath my epidermis.
That's disgusting.
It is. It is.
Are you going to like turn into the fly?
Yeah, or I'm going to like slowly decompose like the stop motion at the end of Evil Dead.
Okay. Are you going to turn into grits?
That's right. You're going to see those grits.
I'm just going to be like, guys, this is a live feed. He has turned into grits. He's turned into grits. They're grits. I haven't eaten them, but they look like grits.
That's what happens when you've been in Texas for 1 month.
I think that's what it was.
I moved back to Texas 1 month ago today, I'm pretty sure.
Lindsay and I did not get bit.
Well.
It just, they came for your ass.
They knew.
But anyway.
Fresh blood from Southern California made it to Central Texas.
We're going
to
fuck this guy. Excuse me. I'm not even drunk.
Are you gonna eat that panda while we're doing it?
No.
Okay.
I'm full. I was putting it up. I'm feeling myself. I was feeling myself.
All right. Well, I was feeling myself when we were watching. We didn't even say it yet, in case you haven't read the title of this episode.
I was about to do the wrong one. Or is it
No, it's doo 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 doo
with the derpy pumpkin.
Oh my gosh.
A fucking pumpkin. I'm gonna get a tattoo of that derpy pumpkin.
I actually like that derpy ass pumpkin.
He was great. It's just like he's so derpy. Anyways, if you guys are listening to this, then you already know what it is. I'm Allegra Jade Fox.
I'm Michael Lewis Cusimano, and this is
I Know What You Watched Last Sunday.
I know what you watched last Sunday.
Technically Saturday today.
Saturday edition, because Halloween fell on a Saturday. The moon was full. The moon was blue. And John Carpenter's Halloween was screening at an outdoor theater in Austin, Texas. And you better believe we were there. We were watching it, and we were enjoying ourselves, or at least I was. I hope. I don't know. Did you enjoy yourself?
I enjoyed myself, but I was really cold.
It got cold.
It got real cold. But it was a great time. I did enjoy it.
Did you?
I did. But I was definitely a little more focused on trying to stay warm.
I'm going to out you real quick.
Okay, out me.
This is the first time you ever saw the movie Halloween.
Yeah. Better late than never.
Better late than never. Like, well said.
I mean, you know, yeah. Also, I think it's interesting to now have that perspective of someone who has seen it numerous times before Saturday versus me, who's like, I understand the culture. I understand the impact that it had. I respect it. I love Jamie Lee Curtis, like, you know, one of the original Scream Queens. But yeah, I've just never seen it, which is crazy because me and my friend Lindsay, who you met last week, we both said the same thing. We'd never seen it, but for whatever fucking reason, we saw Halloween H2O.
It's because of our age. It's because...
That's when Halloween first, you know, because I want to say Josh Hartnett plays her son in H2O because he was the hot throb, the heart throb of that era. So that's like why we all went to go see it. But like, it wasn't until my mom kind of said something. She goes, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis, like... It happened to her first, and I'm like...
You were like, you had no idea? You didn't even... Well, we were, I don't know, 9 years old or something.
Yeah, when Halloween H2O came out, I was...
Because that was the 20th anniversary. That's why they called it that.
So that would have been 98. I was 9 years old. Yeah, like...
I saw Halloween for the first time on TV when I was probably in middle school, and they would do Halloween marathons on Sci-Fi Network. Yeah, and they would go through, and I watched on one Saturday in October all the Halloweens that I could. And they start with... Halloween, then Halloween 2, and it picks up right where Halloween left off, which is kind of cool. And then Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, was a massive disappointment to me, just like it was to everyone who saw that movie when it came out, because there's no Michael Myers, there's no killer, there's no knives. It's about alien pods that are trying to infiltrate children's minds and brainwash them. It's clear out of left field, totally different movie, doesn't belong in the Halloween franchise.
Right. What year did that come out? Because it makes me wonder, was that part of the,
I don't know the exact year, but I can tell you it was so the 80s.
Okay.
It was, like, deeply in the
80s. So Jamie Lee Curtis wasn't even in this one.
But I don't want to get too bogged down in the franchise that is Halloween, because we could do an entire podcast on each entry, and we could talk for hours about how this movie, this series has been rebooted again and again. They have rewritten the backstory multiple times.
Which is so weird.
Well, it's interesting because as the series like went, we are going to talk about this a little bit. The series started to go off the rails with the return of Michael Myers and the curse of Michael Myers. They killed off Jamie Lee Curtis's character because she wasn't going to come back for Halloween 4, which was the return of Michael Myers. But then in the 90s, at the 20-year anniversary, when she did want to come back and do another Halloween movie, they had to go back and basically make a direct sequel to the original two films that she was in.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2018, with the Halloween reboot, they again deleted, just pressed delete on everything subsequent to the first movie and made a direct sequel to the first movie. And there are going to be two more sequels. Halloween Kills is supposed to come out next year. And that is a continuation of this third branch of plot continuity. So in the universe of Halloween, we actually have a multiverse. It's three different timelines. There's Halloween 1, 2, 4, and 5. There's Halloween that goes into the H2O and Resurrection universe. And then there's the new Halloween Kills 21st century reboot. And it's three completely distinct histories. Kind of cool that there's a cinematic multiverse going on with Halloween. But let's zero in and let's focus on 1978's John Carpenter's Halloween. Let's get down to it. Talk to me about 78, baby.
Three things caught my attention.
Let me hear them.
My little itty-bitty thing of notes. The thing that it popped in my head that we mentioned before is the abundance of serial killers in the 70s. Some of the serial killers that we know that live in infamy are like rampant, they are active, or they are on the verge of getting caught. What am I saying? Let's start with Ted Bundy, who was captured in Florida in February of 1978. So at this point, he's already escaped twice, if I'm not mistaken, from Colorado, goes down to Florida, has his killing spree with the sororities, and finally gets captured. Mm. Because remember, he does not get tried in Washington State. He gets tried in Florida and gets the death penalty.
Give me another one.
Hillside Strangler claims his 10th victim that year as well.
Really?
Yes. Not getting caught, but claims his 10th victim.
Give me another
John
one.
Wayne Gacy.
Creepy.
Gets captured, and that is the clown that we know. But then, this has nothing to do with serial killers, but just to show you how crazy it was, Jim Jones and Jonestown.
I mean, that's not necessarily a serial killer, but that is a mass killing. Jinx, you owe me a $2 chuck.
Hey. Yeah, that kind of shook me up. Because I was just like, whoa, because I love true crime stuff and learning about like these serial killers and listening to them, it's always the thing that I used to tell my mom. I'm like, what the fuck is with you guys in doing things like hitchhiking? You know, these killers, that's what they did. They were still just this, I feel like the innocence that were the 50s and the 60s is just...
The 60s wasn't innocent.
It wasn't, you know, but they always say the 60s died when Sharon Tate and those murders, like Helter Skelter's what killed it. But the 70s...
Want to talk about serial killers? Talk about summer of 69.
It's rough, but that's what I'm saying. That's when the 60s, and that's when, like, this American innocence ends, and that's when it's like, now people are starting to lock their doors. People are starting to, like, you can't talk to strangers. And it's just, like, also with Jim Jones, because if you know anything about him, he started off as this preacher for the people. 900 followers are dead because of that. And then the year before, 1977, you have the Summer of Sam. Mm. So this is a very, very, like, violent time for the country in a way. You know, I mean, there was a lot of good in 1978, which I found also interesting that you start to see the rise in the economy in American culture, but there's a lot of violence. And I found it interesting because I start to think that that's what plays into, I'm not going to say the birth of slasher films. because I did a little digging. And no, that is it's not. To start off, guys, the birth or the origin or who started slasher films, I'm going to say, is still debated.
Yeah, it's hard to ever point at one specific moment in history.
And the reason why I'm tying this is because a lot of people say Halloween was the first.
It was the first mainstream teen slasher movie in what today we can recognize as a well-established subgenre.
Right.
This was the first one that had mass appeal and mainstream success.
Exactly.
It owes a lot to a few movies that came before it. Psycho, 1960.
Ooh, I'm going to go way back.
Oh, great.
So, slasher history, real quick. 1926, The Bat. 1943, The Leopard Man. 1960, Psycho. 1968, Twisted Nerve. And then I found a genre of Italian films called yellow films. Yeah. They're called yellow films because of the paper that they were printed on was the tint of yellow.
Well, the kind of source material, like if you were to, it's kind of like how in the United States we talk about pulp novels and the movie Pulp Fiction, even that title is a reference to pulp stuff.
Exactly.
And in Italy, these like, you know, pulpy, violent books are on yellow paper or with yellow covers,
and
I should say.
And these films are, when you look at it, they're not slashers, but they are thrillers, psychological. You have that like detective aspect. And it wasn't really until, and I cannot say his name, but you know who he is,
Dario Argento.
Yes.
I have him written down because his films in particular, he's one of the most important voices in giallo.
Mm-hmm. And he's the one that pretty much made it mainstream in Italy, especially with the movie Bird with a Crystal Plum.
Well, I think of Suspiria. I mean, Suspiria, when I hear Dario Argento, Suspiria is the movie
Suspiria
that comes to
came
mind.
Later, but this one...
We watched Opera the other day, which is also a really cool later Argento
but
film.
This particular movie came out in the 1970s, which is what kind of catapulted his career and really put the genre in the beginning of, like, slasher films. I also have 1974 as Black Christmas, because a lot of people like to say that's the first
one. I'm going to talk about Black Christmas, too.
Excellent. So I'm going to pass
my big ones are Argento and the giallo films, Psycho, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is 73.
Yes.
Or 74, maybe. It's either 73 or 74. Mm-hmm. And Black Christmas, which is 74.
Here.
Black Christmas is a huge influence on Halloween.
1974.
And I think we should just dive right into the movie, honestly. Because after these really fun opening credits that I love because it's like, it's become iconic. Come on!
Right. It's just the pumpkin is so derpy.
I know, you love that pumpkin.
Crack me up.
It sets the tone for the whole movie. It's slow. It's a very, very slow push in on the... Shut up. It's a very... You don't like this movie as much as I do, and it's going to show. And I'm going to let our 17 aggregate listeners come and give you the business.
Where did you get that number 17 from?
I think that's how many listeners we have at the moment.
Hey, it's not zero.
No. No.
We got to start somewhere. No, I will say, like, you're right. You love this movie way more than me. I am definitely a first viewer, but
I understand this movie too. And I think if you gave it a chance and understood it, if you watched it more than once when you're not freezing your toes off in the graveyard outside on Halloween
night. Don't say graveyard.
It was kind of like being in a graveyard, and I liked that about it. It was awesome.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
Yeah, it was the right setting. I think you're sleeping on this movie hard, and I'm not going to stop giving you a hard time about it because... You're wrong.
Okay.
It's good. It's scary. It's fun.
Yo,
it's classic.
Cheesed. It's adorable. Like, he's cheesing.
Anyway, credits roll. John Carpenter's score is playing, and we go into like the eye of this jack-o'-lantern, and the first real shot of the film proper is a POV long shot. I meant to time it. I want to say it's probably 3 or 4 minutes. Maybe 3 minutes of a continuous shot, and it's from the point of view of a killer who is looking in the windows at who we'll later find out is Judith Myers and her boyfriend making out, not looking after her younger brother like she's supposed to be. They go upstairs. He has this clown mask on just for fun because it's Halloween 1963.
Mm-hmm.
They go upstairs to do it. We're watching all of this from outside the windows.
Comes back a minute later.
Less than. I did time that one. It was like 35 seconds.
I'm sorry. I am a petty, petty woman. And I was just like, you poor thing.
They wrap up really quick. The killer, the unknown POV killer, goes inside the house, walks into the kitchen, picks up a butcher knife, walks through the dining room to the landing of the stairs. The boy is putting his shirt back on and says, I'll see you later. I gotta go. And leaves. We walk up the stairs, we see topless Judith Myers at her dressing table looking in the vanity. Mm-hmm. She says, Michael! So we find out the name of the person whose eyes we're looking through. Meanwhile, he's put on a mask, I should say that, because now we're looking through, like, the eye holes of the mask, like Batman binocular style.
Yep.
And we see that knife. We actually don't even see the knife penetrate her. We don't see any stabs. We just see her face.
And you see some blood.
Then you see the knife doing a stabbing motion by itself. And then we pan back to Judith. She's got blood all over herself and she dies. He goes back downstairs, walks outside. The parents are just pulling up. Very Scream, you know. The parents get there just as it's all happening. They go, Michael, what are you doing? And they take the mask off, and we find, right when the mask comes off, we flip perspectives and we see who the killer is. It's a little boy, y'all.
I thought that that was a really cool review, like a reveal, because I did that much. I knew that when he did what he did at a very young age, and you know that much I knew. So even still, to look at that and the way that they, like, he's got the knife in his hand, he's got this blank stare, and it just zooms out.
Yeah, this long crane shot,
and you just see the parents just
frozen. It's kind of weird to watch now, because like that's not what would happen. They would definitely be like, what's going on, and go inside the house, but they just freeze there. But it's effective at the same time.
I didn't question it. I was like,
I do for sure. It's like, why is everyone just standing there totally frozen? Well, you don't have anything to say.
But Shock is a bitch. Like Shock, I mean, you see what, he's 8 or 9 year old.
Six.
Kid. Six. You see a 6-year-old kid holding a butcher knife with his little clown outfit on. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I thought it was very effective. It got my attention where I was like, okay. I don't know why I had it in my mind where he was a teen. Like I said, I knew he was young, but I did not know 6 was the magic number.
6. Because 15 years later, which is what we're going to see next on screen, is Halloween Eve.
It's Halloween Eve.
It's the day before Halloween, mm-hmm. October 30th, 1978.
Yep.
And this movie came out the week of Halloween, 1978. So if you're watching it in the theaters, it's like, this is happening right now, which is kind of cool.
Cool, because I feel like here recently, with the exception of a few movies, there's very rare that you see horror movies take place like in the now. I'm also just thinking, like, in the last decade, The Conjuring has been just such a force that, like, almost all of those movies took place in the 70s.
Right. Well, that was based on historical people.
Right.
I think there's a mix of period horror and modern day horror. A lot of horror takes place like right now, but for it to be specifically set like the week of its release,
that is cool.
I think that's really cool. That's a fun theater going experience to be like, oh look, it's literally this exact week. I got so excited to just jump into this. I didn't do my little here's the people that made it section.
Yeah.
Let me just hit it real quick.
I'm going to let you go. I was like, oh, okay, you're just going to jump into it? All
because
right.
I'm giddy. I'm excited. It's Halloween. Anyway, producer Irvin Yablons is how I'm going to go ahead and pronounce that. I don't know if that's right. I'm just going to call him Irvin. Here's a guy in the 70s who's distributing low-budget pictures and finds that he doesn't have a whole lot of low-budget pictures to distribute. Maybe I should make one. And maybe it should be a horror movie. And there's this guy, John Carpenter, who had just done a movie called Assault on Precinct 13. And maybe he'll be the right person to do it, because he can write it, he can direct it, and he can write the music for it. Let me give John Carpenter a call. John answers. He's like, what's the idea? A scary movie? Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll do it, as long as I can have total creative control. And Irvin is like, okay, yeah, that sounds pretty good. So John Carpenter and his girlfriend at the time, Deborah Hill, get together and write a script called The Babysitter Murders. And it's basically what will become the final script, only Irvin is going to be like, yeah, didn't I mention this? It's Halloween. We're doing Halloween and we're going hard on the Halloween thing. Can you call it Halloween? And John Carpenter is like, how about this? John Carpenter's Halloween. And Irvin's like, yeah, go with it. Rock and roll. So that's the movie. They had this title. They had this setting. They had this idea of a faceless, kind of anonymous, silent killer.
Pause real quick.
Yup.
So throughout the podcast, guys, because like I said, I'm going to let Michael roll. I'm just going to point out little tropes. The first trope that you just mentioned was the babysitter trope.
Invented here, essentially. Yes,
exactly. Which is based on urban legends of...
Actually, no. When a Stranger Calls probably gets that.
When did that movie come out, though? Hold on. I'm gonna figure that out right now, because I feel like When a Stranger Calls came out a little bit later. But anyways, I would say still...
Pause.
When a Stranger Calls came out in 19... Wait, nope, that's the old... That's the... Hold on. They remade that movie?
In the 2000s, yeah. Oh, you never saw that one?
No.
It's funny.
Let's see. When a Stranger Calls... 1979.
Okay.
So, I will... So, back to my point, I will say that this is one of the first times you see the trope of the babysitter taking care of the kids, and there's a killer out there on the loose, which is actually based on a urban myth of a babysitter who was brutally murdered in her house the night she babysits kids. So, continue.
So, the whole concept is the babysitter murders. Deborah Hill had been a babysitter in her hometown of Haddonfield, not Illinois. I want to say, like, Massachusetts or something, or Haddonfield, New York, somewhere in the Northeast.
Hold on. We could technically say The Sitter was a short film directed by Fred Walton on which his 1979 feature film When a Stranger Calls is based.
When was the short?
1977.
Produced? Okay. So this is in the... There's something in the water about babysitters and them getting killed.
But think about it. The whole idea of it is kind of scary because most of our... Like, any friend that I had that was babysitting... You know, while we were working at gyms, they were babysitting. So it's like you're in somebody's house. Mm-hmm. You don't know their house very well. There's watching their kids.
You're the adult. You're responsible. And even though you're still a kid.
You're 16 and like something happens. There's somebody crazy on the loose. Like that's terrifying as an adult. I can't imagine that as a 15-year-old.
Yep.
And yeah, but continue.
So something in the late 70s is turning people on to this idea. And John Carpenter is feeling it where it's like, okay, what if it's some babysitters who are going to get killed? And Deborah Hill's like, well, I was a babysitter in Haddonfield, New Jersey. And she wrote a lot of the dialogue between the female characters, these young teenage girls. And John Carpenter wrote most of the dialogue between like the sheriff and the doctor who are trying to track down this killer, Michael Myers. So with that, hang on, let me just make sure I just check all my little boxes of... Yeah, John Carpenter wrote the score. He recorded it himself. He credited himself as the Bowling Green Symphony Orchestra because that's where he's from.
He's from Bowling Green.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up. My really good friend. Sorry, this you can cut this. My friend Lauren's husband's from Bowling Green. Also, Cage the Elephants are from Bowling Green. Bowling Green's got some famous people.
Bowling Green, baby.
Interesting.
Tommy Lee Wallace. Art director. Editor, stunt man who is Michael Myers for all the stunts.
Damn.
And he gets a very distinctive honor. He's the one who made the William Shatner mask white and created the most iconic face in the slasher
world. I don't know if you watched it or saw it, but like I remember I was watching some countdown and John Carpenter, like his joke is, you know, he owes William Shatner his career.
Yeah.
Like he will say like that, he's quoted to say that, like, I owe that man my career.
Tommy Lee Wallace came back from the Five and Dime or whatever with two masks, and one of them was a William Shatner mask, and they decided to paint it white so that it and open the eye holes a little bit more. So it is this blank, expressionless face that allows you to project your deepest fears and terror onto its blank canvas. And it was a stroke of genius. It wouldn't have worked without that. Okay, that's all I want to say about the people who made this show. So, we have gone through our opening sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's dead. We know who the killer is. It's young Michael Myers holding that butcher knife with that blank, expressionless stare. Cut to Haddonfield, Illinois.
15 years later.
15 years later, the day before Halloween, we are going to meet... Oh, wait. I'm skipping something already. First, we got to meet Dr. Sam Loomis.
Yes, and he's driving with
Marion Chambers, the nurse, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they are on their way to the institution where Michael Myers has been locked up for 15 years.
Now, mind you, the thing that I picked up on where I was just like, oh, okay... This doctor is like on a 10 from the beginning because the nurse is not real. She's like, okay, yeah, another patient. He's like, no, I've been studying this. I've been talking to him. My hands are in quotations, guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically throwing out a little bit of exposition. In fact, I feel like at any point that there is some background, some storyline exposition, the doctor is the one that explains it. So they're driving to this mental institution. And the first thing that I won't lie, I did not react accordingly, but like it did freak me out, was when they drive to the mental institution and everybody's out. And
yeah, goes, they're like strolling around.
Do they normally let them go out like that? And even I had to go, that is fucking creepy.
It is.
That is so creepy. I don't know what it is with mental institutions, but just to see mentally ill people walking around, you know, and this is like pitch black. Mm-hmm. And immediately the doctor's like, something's wrong. This is not what they do. They're not allowed to walk around, blah, blah, blah. So he goes out to see what's going on and he tells her to stay in the car. But what does she do?
Well, she stays in the car and she gets pretty freaked out when someone,
doesn't she roll the window down? Because I think she's smoking a cigarette.
She is smoking a cigarette.
That's what I'm saying. She does something that wasn't smart. She rolls the window down and then all of a sudden you see these hands mm-hmm. grab her and, you know, she fights it off. She gets out of the car and
she's like ejected from the car yeah. and Michael gets in and
somehow in the 15 years that this dude has been locked up, he learned how to drive and drive very efficiently, might I add.
They do mention it in an upcoming scene where Dr. Loomis is like, well, he was driving very well last night.
What did you do? Give him like did you give him lessons? Because
perhaps someone gave him lessons. That's my Donald Pleasance impression. He has this like funny little British accent.
It's beautiful.
Donald Pleasance is great. He plays this character in like the first 6 movies and the final.
I was going to say, I thought he played it for a really long time.
He does, and the last movie he ever did right before he passed away was, I want to say, it was the 6th installment of Halloween.
It's a trooper, man.
Yep. He was like the only person who maintained his role and was in.
Came back.
Yeah, he was in every one that he possibly could be. Yeah. Excluding Halloween 3, because that one we don't count that.
You're really going to make me watch that one just because I want to know what they did.
You can watch it on your own. It's bad. I hate it. And some people say, oh, no. It's actually a good movie. And if it wasn't in the Halloween franchise, people would have liked it more.
Like a standalone.
Yeah, if it had just been called Season of the Witch and it was like its own thing, that would have been fine. I disagree. I think the movie's bad.
Okay.
Sorry, everybody who made Season of the Witch. It's stupid.
No, for sure. I respect that. So we see Michael Myers beautifully driving away in this
steals
car.
A car.
Yep.
Now, let's cut to where I was trying to get to earlier because I'm just getting so ahead of myself. I'm getting so worked up. We're going to meet our heroine, Laurie Strode, in modern day 1978 Haddonfield. She is instructed to drop off the key at the old Myers place.
Mm-hmm. Because her dad's a real estate agent.
Yeah, her dad's like selling that house. And on her way there, we meet Tommy, who is this young boy that she babysits. He is her charge, and she's going to be over there, you know, the next night, and they're going to have, I don't know. She babysits him, like, every night.
That's what I'm saying. They're close regular. Enough that, like, they know. And he immediately goes in and says, you know, why are you by that house? That house is haunted, blah, 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 like boogeyman, like very neighborhood kid stuff. Like, you know,
every neighborhood in America has
yeah.
a haunted house somewhere where it's like, oh yeah, something bad happened there.
You know, I feel like, yes, like especially with these older houses that have like at this point, you know, these like when the 50s and 60s, these houses, they have stories to them because mm-hmm. I'm from the burbs. Like I don't think a house is.
You grew up in a new build. We That's both grew up in like new build neighborhoods.
Right. Which I feel like we missed out on that. But at the same time,
I grew up in Chicago before I moved to Texas was a much older neighborhood. And it definitely had those old houses and that history.
See, we lived in a new neighborhood, but we had a suicide and a homicide murder. So those houses are haunted as fuck.
Oh,
now.
Lucky you.
Yeah. It's crazy. My dad knew the guy. He was this weird dude that would like, I mean, cut this. It was this weird dude that like would always like a beer gut, would wear Speedos and mow his lawn. And seriously, he would always talk to my dad super friendly. One night they got into a huge fight. She's running out of the house for her life. He's got a shotgun. Guns are down in the lawn. Goes back in the house. Pulls the gun on himself. Michael, they sold the fucking house. They sold the house within less than 2 years.
Mm.
And so everybody was like talking in the neighborhood because like, you know, we all, like everyone knew him. And they were like, the family has to know.
They do. If something like that has happened in the house,
yeah,
there's a legal obligation actually.
And it was so creepy because then it was like, you know, I knew what happened and I was like 8 or 9. And it's just like, are you like, you know, you want to be friendly to them, but you're also like, hey, neighbor. To just stand like on the sidewalk of your house, like, but yeah, no, it's just I don't want to say that's the American culture, but it's just like, yeah, there's always the creepy house or like the creepy neighbor, and that's what this kid is. He's like, why are you going by to that house? And she's very vigilantly going like, I'm just gonna put the key under, watch, look, nothing's gonna happen. But then the POV switches.
We see an over the shoulder shot there of just like the shadow of a face.
Yes.
And I should note, in the script of I looked up, I opened the screenplay of this for a couple of things that, while I was watching it a second time. Well, I wanted to see a few things, but the character of Michael Myers, when he's stalking any of his victims, he's referred to in the direction as the Shadow, which I think is awesome, and it speaks to the visual style that we're going to start to get into.
Well, the other thing that we didn't mention that I appreciate, and I'm actually, I'm not, you know, Michael did say he was going to call me out on this, but I, there are things, elements of this movie that I appreciated. The doctor says right from the beginning, he's going to go back to the house.
Yeah, he knows what he's going to do.
He knows exactly, like, what, like, Michael is very predictable in a way. He's like, no, he's going to go back to this house. He's going to go back to this house. And then literally, you see, he's already at this house. Like, he's already there. Which and makes this, me think that this mental institution's not that far away from Haddonfield.
They say it. There is a line in the movie that tells us how far away it is. And I want to say it's like 100 and something miles.
Okay.
So it's somewhere else, probably in Illinois. And, you know, you could drive there overnight and be there the next day.
Okay.
But it's a long drive. It's not like in another part of the country.
Okay.
But yeah, Michael goes back to the house. We see him inside the house when Laurie drops off the key. And while she's walking away down the sidewalk singing to herself, he steps into the frame and another like over the shoulder shot of her walking away. And it lingers for a long time. And we just hear his breathing inside of the mask. This is really effective, spooky, like dread-inducing, suspenseful shit. Like, he is just watching her dead still, breathing. She's unaware. This is the terror that we're going to elongate for the next, like, 90 minutes
of this
movie.
It's a build. That's the thing that I will say. And it's one of those things where I am a product of very quick moving, you know, like we said, what look with the kind, like with Scream and The Ring, you see something very quickly.
Lots of scares.
Whereas with this movie, I realized very early on that this is a slow burn.
Very slow burn.
It's going to take its time. It's going to build this sense of dread because I'm thinking, you tell me teen slasher, I'm going right into like, okay, we got one death. Where are the rest? And
we're going to wait till the end.
To the very, very end, which was just not what I was expecting. But at the same time, I respect that decision 100%. But let's get back into it. She's on her way to school.
Yep. We see her in school now, and they're having a discussion in English class about fate. She looks out the window, and what does she see across the street? That stolen car that says for official use only. It's like a station wagon. That's Michael Myers' vehicle for the film. And he's standing on the sidewalk on the other side of the car. And you can just barely kind of make out this figure who's looking in the window. Creepy. He's stalking her. Right. This is his MO. He likes to stalk and kill. And after she answers a question about fate, she looks back out the window and he's gone. So that's our second kind of, that's the first time she sees him, but it's our second, you know, one of those, like, there he is and now he's gone.
Right.
Sort of things. School's out, the bell rings, and we
meet up with her friends.
Well, no, first we switch focus to Tommy, the young boy.
Yes.
Getting out of elementary school. He's got a pumpkin. The kids trip him and the pumpkin breaks, and I felt really bad for him. These bullies were really mean. And they're taunting him with stories about the boogeyman. You know what the boogeyman does, right? Mm-hmm. He comes out on Halloween night and he kills you. So we introduce the idea of a boogeyman. And that's what Michael Myers represents in our collective subconscious.
And you will hear Tommy repeat this constantly. Because at first it was, this house is haunted. But from this point on, everything, any weird thing he sees, he's going to associate it with the boogeyman. Because he's at that age where it's like when we were kids, Bloody Mary. This is his thing. This is what any creepy thing he sees from this point on is going to be the boogeyman.
And he's not wrong. That's what this movie is about. It's about what if there was a boogeyman who on Halloween night had one single objective, and that was to stalk and kill people. That's the whole premise of the film, is as simple as that.
Yeah.
And John Carpenter is adamant. It's not a morality tale. It's not about anything more than just, let's have a 90-minute little haunted house, you know, slow burn spook fest, and that's the villain. It's a boogeyman.
And I mean,
to bring
back the context. Look at these serial killers that are getting caught, and you're looking for MOs, and you're looking for reasons, and you just don't get them. They're doing it for the sake of doing it.
And what really drives it home and makes it scary is that this whole thing takes place in every town USA, in a suburb in the middle of the country. It could be you. It could be your family. Mm-hmm. This could be literally like anywhere. Haddonfield is, you know, small town USA.
Yep.
And it brought this kind of terror to the suburbs in a way that was, that you could feel it.
Because, you know, at this point, it's, we're still kind of, you know, it's, everything is, and I mean, we're going to bring this up, but I'm going to start it off by saying the thing that drove me crazy about this movie, nobody locked their doors. But that's how wholesome things were. Like, I would keep looking at Michael going, nobody's locking their fucking doors. Nobody's locking their doors. Why are you not locking your doors?
Nothing bad ever happens in Haddonfield.
Exactly. That's why people used to
hitchhike. Oh, wait, except for that one random murder.
And I think that's what got me, is I'm just like, okay, it's one thing if you were super, super wholesome, but you definitely had a very horrible thing happen 15 years later. But sure, let's not lock our doors.
No, okay. People didn't lock their doors. So we meet back up now with Dr. Loomis,
mm-hmm.
and he's on the phone calling ahead, being like, he's coming, you better brace yourself. And he has found a mechanic's truck that has run off the road. This is somewhere in between the institution and Haddonfield. He's on his way to the house. And he doesn't see, but we see the mechanic, like, in the
he's like in the cornfield.
It's kind of like a cornfield, yeah. And he, or like on some bales of hay or something like that. He dead.
Super dead.
And he's been stripped of his clothes, and because this iconic look that Michael Myers wears, the
jumpsuit.
Yeah, the jumpsuit. It's the mechanic's uniform. So kill count
two.
Although this one doesn't happen on screen. This is an implied kill. Yep. Michael killed this guy and took his clothes. Now we're gonna get to our three girls. Lori Strode, Linda, and Annie, and they're walking home from school.
You find out a lot of things in this scene. Now that you've told me that the fact that John Carpenter's girlfriend wrote a lot of this,
mm-hmm.
it makes a lot of sense, because this dialogue as a former teenage girl is very teenage.
Yeah.
There's things in this world that never change, and the teenage psyche kind of stays the same no matter what. We just now implement technology and certain norms.
It's where's your boyfriend tonight?
Yes,
are
exactly.
you guys getting together?
Are you guys getting together?
He's grounded. El Jerko got grounded.
Such and such. Are you going to ask such and such to the dance? Oh no, I'm going by myself. So there's things that you realize in the dynamic of this. You realize that Jamie Lee Curtis's character is the meeker of the trio, I would like to say.
She's reserved.
And they kind of point that out, I feel like, where, you know, all of them are, well, not all of them. Who's the sheriff's daughter?
Annie
is babysitting too, but she's gonna sneak in a boy, and then their other friend's gonna have beers and stuff because it's Halloween, and they're asking Lori, and she's just like, oh, well, we might carve some pumpkins.
Exactly.
And you're just like, what? Like, you have this place to yourself. The kids will be in bed in no time.
And she's going to prove herself to be a really good babysitter.
Exactly. But she's very by the book. I'm doing my job. And then you find out, like, you never spend your money. You've got to be making loads. Like, you've got to have so much money saved up by all the babysitting you're doing. And she's not spending any money. So it's like, I don't want to call her a square, but of the trio, she is.
Yeah.
She's very, you know.
Jamie Lee Curtis was concerned about that too, playing this role, because she is the extroverted former cheerleader in her personal life. And she was like, it's kind of weird that I'm playing one of these roles that is the role of the three that I'm playing, even though it's the lead, and she was happy to have a lead, is like not my personality.
Right. But yeah, you realize, and then you can even tell by like the way she's dressed. She's got on this like cute little long skirt and like probably like penny loafers, and the other girls have got like the permed more wild hair, flares and platforms. So it's like, okay, she's the...
I don't know if they had like flares and platforms. It's not like Saturday Night Fever going to the disco on Halloween.
I mean, a platform is at least 2 inches.
I can't speak to the shoes. Maybe they were wearing platforms.
As a female, let me take this one.
All right, you got
it. Yeah, they're wearing more of like the fashion that you would see and what's going on, and she's definitely more reserved.
Yeah.
And they kind of poke fun at her about that. But then as they're walking, what happens?
A car pulls up as the one that she saw out the window of the classroom. And this is kind of alarming to her. It, quote unquote, speeds by. And it's either Linda or Annie goes, speed kills. I think Annie goes, yeah, speed kills. And he stops, skids to a halt. Even though the actual car is clearly going like 14 miles per hour in that shot.
But this is anytime USA, who knows? But yeah, but the fact that he stops.
It's kind of creepy that he stops.
It's super creepy.
And she's like, man, can't you take a joke? And he speeds off again. There's a great line. This is actually why I looked up the script. Because when Lori sees the car, the line right before it is Linda is supposed to say, or Lori says, "Oh, I forgot my chemistry book." And the next line, in the way it is in the film, is like, "Oh, well, who needs books anyway? I know I always forget my chemistry book and my history book. Oh, and my English book. In fact, I forget all my books. I don't use my books at all. I think books are for losers." Like, this really long line about books. In the script, it's one sentence. And I looked it up because it confirmed my suspicion that John Carpenter was like, "Oh, we need to, like, keep filling more time for this shot. Can you just ad-lib a little bit more after this line?" And that's the ad-lib that we get. It's about books. The books monologue is so funny to me.
It's a mood because I never brought my books home.
Those
motherfucking books were heavy. I don't know. When she said that, I was like, that's a mood, and I appreciate you.
Shout out to PJ Souls, who plays Linda, and Nancy Loomis, as she's credited in this movie, who plays Annie. Love that she's credited as Loomis, because Sam Loomis is the doctor's name, too. And that name, Sam Loomis, actually comes from Psycho.
Oh, because who was the lead in Psycho?
Janet Leigh.
Who is
Marion Crane? Mom? Jamie Lee Curtis's mom. It's all coming full circle. It's me trying to do a little ding, ding, ding. Sorry. we have multiple references to Psycho. Sam Loomis. Thank you. Sam Loomis. And then Marion Chambers is the nurse from that first scene with the doctor. Marion Crane is Janet Leigh's character in Psycho. So we're nodding and winking to Psycho. Just like Scream with Mrs. Loomis and Billy Loomis is going to wink at these predecessors.
I think it's so wholesome that, like, horror movies always are, like, giving props where props due, and they're doing their little, like, little quiet shout-outs. Like, I think that's really cool.
It's fun when you're in the inn with that.
Right.
Like, oh, I know what you're talking about.
There's like, especially, like, the Loomis is something that's almost, like, now 40 years old, that it's, like, that's really cool that they did that.
And we're, like, in the club. It's over 40 years old. It's 60 years old if you go back to Psycho.
Huh, yeah.
And 42 years old if you go back to Halloween.
And then Scream is
Scream's 25?
25. The 25th anniversary.
It's coming up.
Yeah, it's coming up.
Coming up next year. All right.
Whew.
One of my favorite shots in the movie is this this kind of hedge scare. Michael Myers standing next to this hedge down the sidewalk, and then he just steps behind it. That's all. Broad daylight. Do we just see this spooky-looking guy with a mask on step behind a hedge?
But that's the thing. I think that's the reason why it works, is that it's fucking Halloween. Mm-hmm. If that happened any other day, you'd be super alarmed. But it was like just last week with Halloween. I saw people wearing masks looking creepy, and it's just like I didn't blink an eye because I'm like, oh, it's Halloween. I'm in my costume, they're in their costume. Mm-hmm. And that's why the girls kind of brush it off, where it's just like, oh, okay, well, he's already ready for Halloween, and they go about their business. Because,
yep.
Again, had it been any other day, there would have been more alarms raised quickly. But
Annie brushes it off. She's like, oh, it's nothing. She goes over there. She looks behind the head. She's like, oh, Lori, he wants to ask you out on a date. And Lori's kind of like, are you serious? Are you really talking to this person? I think it's actually a psycho, and goes and looks. Nobody's there. Again, Michael Myers, he's there, then he's not. Where is he? Where did he disappear to?
He moves fast.
But not when he's, like, gonna kill you, though. He just walks.
Which is kind of gangster.
I know.
I mean, because let's just say, Scream, they're fucking running after you. But to me, I don't know. It's something about something killing you going slow.
Dude walks,
like,
yep.
Yeah, it's like all the zombies up until 28 days later just took their time. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, I'll get to you.
There's a little fake-out scare here at the hedge where it actually turns out to be Sheriff Brackett, who is Annie's dad, and he's going into the Brackett house where Annie just dropped her off. We also find out earlier on in the scene that both Lori and Annie are going to be babysitting across the street from each other. That's three houses down. It's really across the street. And Linda and her boyfriends are kind of make plans to, like, go over to one of those houses to do their...
To
do their dirty sex.
To do the sex. They're going to do the sex.
There's a phone call from Lori's house. She talks to Annie. She looks out the window, and Michael Myers is standing behind the clothesline, halfway obscured by these sheets that are blowing. And when she kind of looks over at the phone that rings and looks back, he's gone. Annie and Lori are like, okay, yeah, we got to go babysit now. Annie comes and picks her up. They get high on their way to go babysit. How do you feel about that?
As a person that's not the biggest fan of children, I understand.
I'm just surprised that Lori does it. Annie, totally. She does not care. Lori is a good babysitter, though. She saved some children's lives.
I mean, yeah, but, you know, I don't know. It didn't surprise me that, like, you know, that's the thing, is that having sex is the trope. Doing drugs isn't.
Drinking, doing drugs, sex. If we go by the rules that Scream establishes,
true.
Drinking and doing drugs are rule number two. So Lori does break this rule. But she's kind of like, she kind of reluctantly smokes and she coughs. She obviously doesn't smoke weed a lot. Don't Fear the Reaper is playing in the car ride.
Totally caught that.
Yeah, love it. And another, just even yet another reference from Scream 20 something years later. They play Don't Fear the Reaper in the scene between Billy and Sydney.
Yes.
A cover of it, like a slow kind
of
acoustic.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not the
original. It's like an acoustic cover. While they're driving, getting high, we cut away, actually, and we meet Dr. Loomis again, going with the groundskeeper of the cemetery to go look for Judith Myers' headstone. It's missing.
Dun, dun, dun. Ding. And the kid, and the groundskeeper's very like, oh, these damn kids, it's Halloween. And again, Loomis, who just knows, he's like, no, there's a reason for this. The thing that I will say about this that I thought was very surprising for me, maybe it's because it's 2020 and I just assumed, the sheriffs listen to the doctor.
For the most part.
They really do. I was expecting, again, just as a person that's never seen it, I was expecting more pushback because law and science tend to push back in these tropes.
He gives a little bit of pushback. He's skeptical.
He's skeptical, but he
begrudgingly goes along with,
right.
with
like,
Dr. Loomis.
I don't know why I thought it would be more like, this is a wholesome town and we don't have this. Like, that's
we
what
do
I,
get that. He does.
We get it, but he still just kind of goes, well, you know, I hope you're wrong kind of thing. But I was very surprised to see him cooperating with very little pushback. Because, again, first time watcher, guys, I just expected it to be, like, more pushback because that's what you typically see.
There is a line from the sheriff where he's like, this is Haddonfield. You know what we have here in Haddonfield? Rows and rows of houses of happy families and happy children. You're telling me that they're lined up for the slaughterhouse? And Dr. Luna says, well, they might be. And he's like, okay, fair enough. Then let's keep our eyes peeled. Anyway,
real
Tombstone's
quick.
Gone. Cut
real
back.
Quick.
Oh,
halfway.
What you got?
Real quick. There are no black people in this movie, guys. None. Not one. There's none. This is the first movie that I've seen no black people.
There's not a one, huh?
There's not a one.
There's not a one black person in Haddonfield.
Not one. Not even.
That's why people don't lock their doors.
I mean, listen. Didn't it cross my mind? I'm like, oh, so 6-year-old killing and stabbing his sister, you're still going to leave your shit unlocked. Oh, that's because there's no black people. Huh. I'm done.
All right. We'll put a little pin in that. Ain't no black people in Haddonfield.
Hey, I bring it up every podcast.
But you know what did happen in Haddonfield? A hardware store got robbed. And we find that out because Lori and Annie pull up to the... They see
her
dad,
which,
the sheriff, and she's like, oh, shoot, get rid of this joint.
Which I'm like, bitch, he could smell it.
I know.
I love that, where I'm like, y'all caught. He's just busy, and he's probably like, fucking teen.
He comes up to the window of the car, and he says, somebody robbed the hardware store, but they only took... Or this is right before they pull up. All they took were a couple of knives and a couple of masks, a mask.
I think it was a couple of masks and a knife.
I think it's a couple of knives, because we do see... never mind. There's a part at the end where the knife that has tracked its way upstairs, we see it again on the floor of the living room in the very last shots. So I think he may have multiple knives. And I think the line,
if I was a serial killer, I would have multiple knives.
He's knived out.
You just never know.
In an instant, it goes from like dusk to like pitch black.
Yeah. I was like, how long did it take? I thought Haddonfield was a small town. Did it take them 3 hours to get there?
Nope. We just had to shoot at night, and we shot the other scene during the day because this movie was on a pretty low budget.
And wasn't it really quickly filmed? Like, I want to say it didn't even take 2 months.
Definitely less than that. Yeah. This was a quick shoot. I can't tell you exactly how long it took for photography, but
okay.
Yeah, definitely a quick shoot with a small crew. I mean, the art director was also the stuntman, was also the editor. Like, that's how this isn't as ragtag as something like Evil Dead or as micro budget as Paranormal Activity, but this is a low budget film that just became a runaway hit. So the girls arrive at their respective homes to babysit Tommy. What did I just say? Doyle. The Doyle house.
The Doyle house.
And,
Wallace?
Lindsay Wallace. Yeah, yes. I knew a Lindsay Wallace in elementary school. That's why it was killing me that I couldn't think of it.
I was going to point out that, like, as, you know, they're at their houses, they're doing their thing. It is literally night and day, the relationship between babysitter and child is what I noticed.
Oh, yeah. Lori's a good babysitter.
Yes, Lori's a good babysitter. She's
Annie
very attentive.
Deserves what she gets because she's a bad babysitter.
Yeah.
Just like Judith deserved what she got because she wasn't looking after Michael while the parents were away. She was busy canoodling upstairs.
But it doesn't matter anyways because Michael still goes after Jamie Lee Curtis's character.
That's true.
That's what I'm saying. It has nothing to do
with... but she doesn't get it. Everybody else gets it.
But he's not like it did. He's not like without trying.
That's true.
So because that was the thing that I always kind of got confused was I thought that like I guess I got confused of like what triggered him and I thought it was more of the sex babysitter thing just from again
he's like the Mike Myers is like the shark in Jaws.
He's just going
he doesn't
for it.
Need a reason to kill.
He just does
killing
it.
Is what he does.
Exactly.
That's all.
But I did think it was really interesting to see like, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis's character, they're watching horror movies, they're going to carve pumpkins, they're having a good time. You go over to the Wallace house, and literally, Lindsay is like a zombie with on the couch just watching something that I think is wildly inappropriate.
The Thing.
The Thing, that's just the old school Thing.
I love that she's watching The Thing,
and
because 2 years later, John Carpenter will direct the remake of The Thing.
And it's pitch black, and there's just no relationship. Like, in fact, even when Annie calls...
No, she's over in the kitchen. She's making popcorn. She's worried about other stuff. She just wants to go pick up her boyfriend, Paul.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
all she cares about, is going and getting Paul and having her fun. Before we really see much between them, though, Sheriff Brackett and Dr. Loomis go into the old Myers house, and we have a little monologue from Dr. Loomis about how this child that he watched for 15 years spent 8 years trying to understand him and then 7 years trying to keep him locked up.
Mm-hmm.
And
like
he had
I said,
the darkest eyes.
You
and
find
behind
all
those
the,
eyes was pure evil.
All the exposition is there. Because
yep.
if it wasn't for Dr. Loomis's character, you would not have an idea. You would have no clue, nothing. You would know nothing really about Michael Myers except that he's a deranged killer, that he's just targeting young women.
And that's really true. That's
really
the case. He's just
really
pure
true.
Evil. He is
but
the
then,
boogeyman.
As a person that, you know, liking and being interested in true crime, you want to have an explanation. Loomis gives you an explanation, but it is definitely not what you want. You want something where you want to hear something triggered him or he went through this psychosis. But the fact that he's like, yeah, I worked with him for 7 years and then I've spent the remaining time to make sure that this motherfucker never gets out.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I went, okay, this is somebody with absolutely no motive whatsoever except to kill for the love and the sake of killing.
We'll learn more in the sequel about how he's actually secretly related to Laurie. And then after that, we'll go back and delete that storyline and retcon that out. So I don't want to get bogged down in all that stuff because for the purposes of this movie, for this little script that was supposed to be nothing more than a holiday thrill ride, yeah, it's a killer with no motive. That's what we know from
mm-hmm.
this version of the story. And here it is. Halloween night. The sun has set. The girls are at their houses. The parents are gone. We never meet any of the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we meet the sheriff. But, I mean, this is a theme of parental absence that it's a part of the setting and it's a part of, like, this world that we're living in. We're living in kids' world. We're living in the high school and younger universe.
Which just makes me wonder, if this is a small town, where the hell are the parents?
I have been trying to figure this out. It's Halloween night. These kids do not go out trick-or-treating. They stay home with their babysitters, and the parents go out.
Right. Where are they?
I also looked up what day Halloween was in October
of 78.
It was like a Tuesday. It wasn't like a Saturday night or something.
Right.
So
it's like, were they throwing, like, a swingers party? Like, I'm not gonna lie. This actually legitimately bothered me.
It's pretty suspicious, yeah.
It's very suspicious.
They're depriving their kids of a fun Halloween.
Well, Tommy had a costume on. I thought, like, she'd made a comment that he'd gone trick-or-treating earlier.
I'd have to view it again, but okay. I don't think so.
Because
I do not think
Lindsay definitely is not dressed up. Like, no. There's nothing of that. But yeah, I just definitely was like, hey, where the fuck are the parents that two kids on the same street are being babysit on a Tuesday night? What's up with that?
On Halloween.
On Halloween. In small town. It's one thing if they live like 30 minutes away from Chicago or something like that. Like, I'd like to think that this is as Midwest as it gets in Illinois.
Central Illinois, yeah.
Central.
It's suburban, rural-ish.
Exactly. Like, anyways, that definitely just on top of nobody locking their doors.
Well, anyway, Annie gets some butter on herself and has to go wash her clothes.
I think, very little butter and insists on taking off all of her clothes.
Yep.
And
she gotta go wash them. Michael Myers is standing outside, kind of watching this happen. We see another over-the-shoulder shot of him stepping into the frame, watching her from the outside. He kills Lester, the dog.
You know, sad. I feel like any movie that shows when they kill the dog, they mean business.
Oh yeah, this is he's ruthless, and this I think that says something about the character. That
yes,
there's a German Shepherd messing with me. Okay, goodbye.
Like, that was it. And all he was doing was barking.
Poor dog. Well, that's going to mess him up because he's trying to kill Annie right now. I don't know why he's got a sight set on Annie, but he does. I think he's circling in.
Part of me wonders if it was because of the comment she made earlier that day.
Speed kills?
Mm-hmm.
That really set him off. He couldn't handle that. He's like, I'll show you.
I mean, who knows? But then, again, you see this relationship with her and the kid that she's watching, Lindsay, is not good because she gets stuck in the shed. And she is yelling. She's trying to get her attention.
The way she gets stuck is terrible, though. Like, the shot that you see is, she wasn't stuck at all.
No.
She could have just stood right up. No matter. While she's stuck, Paul calls, and that's her boyfriend. So she's going to go pick up Paul. She decides to drop Lindsay off across the street and let Lori watch Lindsay while she goes and picks up her boyfriend. She forgets her keys to the car, goes in and gets them. Michael's watching her. We're building the suspense, building the tension.
Yes.
When she finally gets in the car, who's in the back seat?
Michael Myers.
Michael.
And he strangles her.
And then stabs her.
Yeah.
That's his MO. That's what we're going to see, is that he likes to strangle, he likes to choke, and he likes to stab.
Yep.
Usually in that order.
Yep.
If he had his way, that's what he would probably do to everybody.
Yep.
Choke him, then stab him.
Do a little stabby stab.
Death number three. We cut to those bullies that we talked about earlier who were chanting about the boogeyman. They're in front of the old Myers house on Halloween. And Dr. Loomis, who's like hiding behind a hedge, just like does a voice to get them out of there. He's like kind of sadistic.
Okay, let's go back to what... So at this point, and pretty much for like the duration of this movie, the sheriff and Loomis have this conversation. And, you know, it's when you said like, you know, this is a lined up neighborhood. You know, do you think anything's going to happen? Dr. Loomis stays at the house.
Yes.
Because
he's convinced Michael's going to come back.
Exactly.
Little does he know, he already did, and now he's out.
Exactly.
But he's about to find out that when he finds that car that he was driving that got stolen, he's like, oh, he's already here. We need to see where he's at.
Right.
What's he doing? Meanwhile, Bob and Linda and her boyfriend, they pull up. In this really cool-looking van, they pull up to the house where Annie is babysitting, Wallace house.
Right in, try to find her.
No one's there.
No one's there. And so instead of just being like, oh, well, let's go check on our other friend to see where Annie is, they just go upstairs and fuck.
Yeah.
Teenagers. Why not?
Well, they got a plan. Even before they walk in, they're talking about like, okay, so we'll say hi to them and then we'll go upstairs and I'll take your clothes off and you take my clothes off. And it's like, they have a fuck plan for what they're going to do when they get inside. So it's one track mind. They've got beer. Every single location that we see them in, there's a new beer can that they like toss on the ground because it's empty. Beer cans fall out of the van. They toss down an empty beer can on the couch downstairs. When we cut up to the bedroom, there are beer cans on the floor there. He's going to get up and go get another beer. It's like
they've knocked down at least a 12 pack. It's impressive to be 17 and see them knock it all back.
The beers just keep coming. There's a jack-o'-lantern next to the bed.
Which no one's paying attention to.
Oh, I paid attention to that.
No, I mean, like, they're not paying attention to it.
I thought that was so weird that there's a jack-o'-lantern. Art direction in this has the beer cans on the floor and a jack-o'-lantern next to the bed.
I feel like Mike Myers put it there.
No, he did. Really?
I feel like he would have.
Theories.
I mean, my thing is I'm like, it's like.
Because he's in the room. While they're like hooking up in the bed, his shadow moves across the wall.
I feel like.
Again, the shadow.
When I first watched it, I read it as he put it there. Like, I didn't even really like look into it. I'm like, he put it there.
Mm.
Like, that's a way of saying like, something has shifted in the house. Any normal person would have been, what the fuck is there a jack-o'-lantern doing inside of a house? I don't know, because you know how like serial killers do that. They in the horror movies, they move stuff around just ever so slightly. And
not
him,
Michael.
I don't know. I read it as he put
it.
I
love it. I love what you're saying. I feel like the art director Tommy Lee Wallace was just like, well, what do we need in this room? Let's put some beer cans here and let's put a jack-o'-lantern here.
Well, because
it looks good.
Because of the upcoming scenes of what he does later is what made me think, oh, he put it there. Like, there's a method to his madness.
Fair enough. Let's talk about these glasses that Bob wears.
That I fucking need in my
life. Yeah, I love them. They're really cool.
They're so great.
After they do it, it takes like 30 seconds for them to have sex. And she goes, fantastic. And he says,
liar.
I'll be right back. This is like the establishment of that rule.
I would definitely say this, you know, this is it.
This like puts it into the lexicon.
Never say you will be back. So he goes downstairs.
Oh, and this is great. I love the way he dies.
This death scene is dope.
I love the way he dies. This is where we start playing with like, you don't know where Michael is. You know someone's there. He's looking out the window. He's looking behind the doors. He's going, okay, very funny. Come out. And something that I just want to highlight about how John Carpenter crafts the atmosphere and the scares in this movie is that the whole concept is you never quite know where he's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And once night falls, the shot compositions that we see, he's using foreground and background where you've got your person, whether it's Laurie or one of the other characters in the foreground, and the negative space of the frame, you're always looking there. Like, is he going to be behind that door? Is he going to be in that window? Where is he going to pop up next? And it's so incredibly effective. It like really makes you try to guess. Like, every time there's blackness on the screen, every time there's empty space, negative space, you're wondering if something's going to appear. And later he delivers on that promise in some really great ways where... And here's one of those times where the door opens, the closet door opens, and it's like the second door, and who springs out but Michael Myers, and he grabs Bob by the throat.
He fucks Bob up.
Lifts him up against the wall, his feet are off the ground, he stabs him, the knife is like a stake that pins him to the wall, which, well, physics aside, it's definitely cool that that happens. And that's it for Bob. And there's this one shot that every time I see it, it shows his feet and he's barefoot and his feet are like flexed and then the life goes out of them. And I always expect blood to drip down on the floor. If this were a Giallo film, you would see that bright ruby red blood mm-hmm. come like drip onto the floor. If this were a later slasher movie that's relying on gore effects, you would see blood come down. And it's an opportunity for like the blood to just like drip down or come out of his mouth or something. And none of that happens. This movie is almost a bloodless film, which is not what you think of when you just think Halloween slasher movie. There is almost no blood in this movie because that's not the source of the terror. The way John Carpenter is crafting the terror in this movie is through suspense. It's Hitchcockian in its approach. It's not gore. It's not throw everything in. It's the opposite of Evil Dead, what we talked about last week, where it's every effect you can muster. It's as few effects as you can use and build the tension. And this, I mean, it's like John Carpenter is composing the way a musical composer uses tension and then release. Once the release happens, once the death happens, that's the end of that sequence. We don't linger on, you know, the gore, the body, the bleeding, the carnage. It's all about the suspense leading up to it. And that's what makes this movie so effective. And that's what I think helps it to stand the test of time, because it's not relying on anything sensational in what you're seeing. It's all about what you're not seeing and what you're waiting for. Thank you. You okay?
I'm just listening.
I know. That was what I really wanted to get out.
I'm listening.
Anyway, Bob dies, and we cut to a long shot, a two shot of him up on the wall and Michael Myers looking at him. And this was like the only direction that John Carpenter gave to Nick Castle, who played Michael for most of the shots, is I want you to look up at this body and turn your head in fascination as if you're looking at a butterfly collection. And that is exactly what it looks like. Like, he has this specimen pinned to the wall, and he's fascinated by it. Like, ooh, look what I just did. And it's chilling, in my opinion. I think that shot is, like, really, Bob dies. We go back upstairs to where Linda is reclining, waiting for her beer to arrive. Mm-hmm. And Michael Myers uses those killer awesome glasses for his ghost sheet costume.
Here's the thing. I was pleasantly surprised at how intelligent Michael Myers was. Like, watching that movie the other night, that was a thing that I was not expecting, just because I've heard big, dumb killing machine so often in, you know, these beginning origins in like 80s horror movies, that I'm like, okay, he knows how to drive a car. Mm-hmm. He knows how to evade and be sneaky. Mm-hmm. He knows how to hide and, you know, wait for his prey. And then the fact that he comes in and creates a diversion, it's like he's intelligent enough to know what's going on and that he needs to just, I don't know, like I said, it's not like he's super, super intelligent, but for somebody that's been locked up and not had human contact since he was 6 years old, he's very, very, very intelligent.
He's methodical.
He's very methodical.
He's been planning this moment, according to Dr. Loomis, staring at that wall, dreaming, thinking, imagining this day.
And that's the thing, is that you hear him say it, and it's not until you see it. Because, like, yeah, it's a funny scene, but for me, I'm like, again, I don't want to, you know, I never said that he was stupid, but it's just, again, you know, in this time when somebody is, you know, a mute, because he's essentially a mute, you know, you really can't measure his intelligence. But it's like, he's extremely intelligent. And the fact that he's been staring at this wall, that is another level of crazy. But like you said, he is a hunter.
He's dangerous.
That's the way that I viewed this movie, is I'm like, yes, this is a serial slasher movie, blah, blah, blah. But he is a hunter. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're watching this for sport, like, you know, it reminds me of the story, The Dangerous Game. Mm-hmm. That's who he is. He is, you know, baiting. He is waiting patiently. You know, for him, it's like, I've waited 15 years to do this. What's another hour? What's another 2 hours?
He's restrained. And he wants them to be terrified, I think. He wants his victims to be... He sees himself as the boogeyman that other people see him as. He wants to be
exactly. But and that was the thing that caught me off guard, that also did unnerve me, is I'm like, if a human were to hunt another human, they would be Michael Myers, you know. And you know, because it's like, you do have Freddy Krueger and, you know, Billy and Stu, who more so like to play with their food before they eat it. Not Michael. Michael is going to make sure that you are pissing on yourself while he kills you and he watches the life leave your eyes. And that to me was what got me, is that it's like, yeah, you're giggling when he shows up and she's all like, oh, take the mask off. Where's my beer? And he's just standing there.
See anything you like is one of her lines.
And he just stands there and you see him put the glasses on and you're just like, bitch, you don't even know. You're about to get fucked.
Yep. So she goes to the phone. She says, this is going nowhere, and calls Lori across the street. And while she's on the phone, that cord of the phone goes around her neck. And Lori on the other side hears her choking, gagging. Once again, I'm reminded of Scream. This movie is the biggest single inspiration for Kevin Williamson's Scream of all of the different ones.
Absolutely.
It's based directly on Halloween, and I realize that more and more watching it recently.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm
saying. We've got the person on the other end of the phone hearing the death, hearing Linda being killed. So, obviously, Lori's going to grab her keys and go across the street to see what the heck's going on. And this is some really, really good shit. This is when it really starts to hit the fan, because she goes upstairs, she's looking for everybody. And when she walks into that bedroom, Annie's body has been moved from the car. Oh, I should go back and mention that Tommy actually sees Michael carry Annie's body. He's looking out the window across the street.
And he's yelling about the boogeyman.
And he says, I see the boogeyman over there. This is like the second time he says, I saw the boogeyman. He was over there.
And Linda?
Linda is the
Glenn is the one that got stabbed.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, who's Jamie Lee Curtis's character?
Laurie Strode.
Laurie, at this point, is getting a little annoyed with him and saying, you know, there's nothing out there. Mm-hmm. There's nothing out there.
She says, there's no such thing as a boogeyman. I'm not going to let anything happen to you.
Yes. And, yeah, so she goes over. She goes upstairs. She sees her friend's body
placed on the bed
with the missing headstone of Judith.
And this is why I think Michael is relating Annie, who is a bad babysitter who abandons her charge, to his sister, who wasn't paying attention to him 15 years ago on Halloween. He's making a statement like, look, here's Judith Myers.
And that's why
again,
I think
he's recreating that.
And that's why I think the pumpkin was the same thing.
I feel you then. You know what? It's all coming together now.
I don't know. Like
the jack-o'-lantern was his.
Again, y'all, first viewer, my notes have been gone 30 minutes ago. I am just now telling you, I am reviewing this as a person that just seen it. I seen it 7 days ago. I thought it was just, you know, to go from the jack-o'-lantern and to go from that headstone, because that headstone makes a fucking impact.
It sure does. So we see that body with that headstone. Bob's body swings out of the darkness. Here's like that negative space, those dark shadows. Something does pop out like a haunted house. And then the door next to it swings open and Linda's body is in there. So it's like Halloween, carnival, haunted house, like scare fest for Laurie right now, discovering all her friends' bodies within 15 seconds in that room. So she's beside herself. She runs back downstairs. Michael Myers appears in the dark. Michael Myers appears. That white mask just apparates, like materializes in the dark. And she takes a step and he goes for her. And she turns and falls down off the railing.
No. Turns. He doesn't stab her. It's like he barely misses.
He cuts open her shirt. Yeah.
And she falls over. And I love that because it's like you're falling as her.
Yeah. Really cool shot of like just zooming towards the ground. And she's like fine. I mean, it's amazing that she fell off that balcony
Adrenaline is a bitch. And then she gets up, runs across the street. Now this is
my question. She trips on her way.
This is my question. So she had her keys.
She did. We saw the keys in her hand.
Okay.
When she left.
She looks
at them and puts them in her pocket.
Okay.
But we do not see her lock the door on her way out. And this is a little problem that I have.
Okay.
Because we don't see her lock the door from the outside.
So preference, guys. We were trying to figure this out a couple of days ago. Because again, first view. I'm going to repeat that so many times. I'm going to repeat it one more time. We were trying to figure out the other night if Tommy had locked the door and she went across the street she's running. And I said, no, she had her keys. I remember because, again, back to my point, there are no locked doors, okay?
She locks the door. We don't see her do it, but we got to assume.
Linda just come on in. Annie, just come on in. At this point, everybody's just coming on into each other's houses. This is the first time in this whole freaking movie
that we
see somebody consciously lock the door, check the keys, put them in her pocket. So then when she's attacked by Michael Myers, falls over, that is to me at some point is when the keys are lost.
Yeah.
Because then she runs back to the house, starts banging on the door to get Tommy to wake up.
She bangs on the neighbor's door and they're home. They turn on the light and she's screaming, help me. And they turn the light back off and don't open the door.
Bystander effect, nothing happens in our town. I'm just going to ignore it.
Y'all!
Bystander effect is a thing.
Y'all, these neighbors, oh man.
I'm just saying, the bystander effect is real, and that is exactly what you witnessed.
The bystander effect is where if other people are witnessing the same thing that you are, you assume that someone else is taking responsibility. There's a diffusion of responsibility.
So could it be the same thing as far as an audio thing, where it's like we're all hearing it, but maybe somebody else will take it?
Sure, yeah, because someone else probably already called the cops or something. But all they had to do was open their damn door. She needed help. She needed them to open the door and let her in. She's a 17-year-old girl.
Or we could say it was a trick or treat because it's Halloween. Maybe they thought it was a trick. Either way, it's
whatever they thought, they screwed her over. Because she then runs back over to the Doyle house. She's banging on the door. She goes, oh, my keys. Where are the keys? And she throws a pot up to the window where Tommy and Lindsay are both asleep. And Tommy comes down and lets her in just in the nick of time.
Yep.
But when she gets in there and she sends the kids away, you know, go down the street and call the police, she sees that the window is open. Oh, no. Mm. Michael could be in here somewhere. So I guess I'll just sit down on the couch. She just like sits down with her back to that window, with her back to the couch. Michael Myers is behind the couch. Of course he is. He swings and misses really terribly. She grabs a knitting needle, goes into his neck. Still no blood though. And yeah, she thinks that Michael Myers is dead, but she did not do a good job of ensuring that. And she even picks up his knife that he swung at her with and then puts it back down before she goes upstairs.
In the closet, hides in the corner, grabs a wire.
This is a great, this is so iconic, this scene.
The next couple of minutes is an exciting scene.
And ties a little rope around the handles. I don't know why there are handles on the inside of the closet doors, but there are, and she ties them together.
He comes through.
And pulls that, it's like a pull string for the hanging light bulb. And so once he starts breaking through, this light bulb is kind of going off and on. It's so Haunted House. Like, it's great. And she grabs a wire hanger, straightens it out, stabs him in the eye with it, which temporarily incapacitates, or it stuns him so that she can grab his knife, stab him in the gut, and that incapacitates him.
Right. Then she runs,
It's over.
She's sitting there, but then the way the camera is so beautifully placed.
Once again, using that negative space over the shoulder of the person in the foreground.
Then all of a sudden, you just see her reacting, and you just see the body, and you just see it.
He gets up like Nosferatu.
He just slowly comes up, and it's just like yet another iconic scene. Jamie, look behind you.
Behind you, Jamie.
Behind you, Jamie.
Behind you.
Behind you.
Jamie, behind you. She gets up. She's like slowly kind of pacing away. He sneaks up behind her, and in what's a little bit of a deus ex machina, as he's grabbing her, strangling her, Dr. Loomis shows up because he's figured everything out and he kind of knows where to go, I guess. Shoots Michael, first use of a gun, shoots him 6 times.
Not in the head.
Unloads on this dude. He staggers back and falls out the window or off of the kind of balcony thing, I guess, onto the front lawn. And we get the final lines of the movie. She says, "It was the boogeyman." And he says, "As a matter of fact, it was."
But then when they go to look for the body?
Gone.
Completely gone.
Chilling. And then we get, with the score kind of like crescendoing, these shots, static shots of all the locations where we've been, where something terrible has happened. Like, here's the living room with the knife still on the floor. There's the the exteriors of the houses. Here's the staircase where she fell. And it's like, this is your house. This is my house. You hear the breathing inside the mask as it's doing all these shots before it's finally like, he's still out there. That's like the impression that's trying to give you. It's like, he's out there. He's in your town. He's in my town. Happy Halloween, everybody.
And that's it.
That's the movie. What do we want to say about it? I think we said...
said plenty. Plenty. So, out of 5 pumpkins, what would you give it?
Quality-wise?
Yes.
I think I'm going to give it...
How many derpy pumpkins?
I'm going to give it, like, 4.
4 derpy pumpkins?
Well, it's... I mean, it's hard, because I can't just give movies that I like a 5 every time. And there are some flaws with this movie. There is a huge lack of backstory. Some of the dialogue is kind of weak. It's not a perfect film, but it's a really, really, really effective one, especially appreciated in the context of the time that it was released, that nothing like that had ever been done before, and when you think about the impact that it's had. So I'm going to give it a good 4 out of 5.
Excellent.
As far as scare factor...
Yes. How many derpy pumpkins?
I will say, the first time I saw this movie when I was a kid, this is the first movie I can remember lying awake at night and wondering if Michael Myers was in the closet or if he was like on the other side of that door. It got under my skin. As an adult, is it really that scary? I don't know. But the idea is, you know, we got to go by more than just like, did this really like make me jump? Is the idea behind it terrifying? The idea of a real life boogeyman. So I'll give it a 4 for that as well. Okay. Maybe a 3, maybe a 4. What about you? Quality. How many,
derpy pumpkins.
Well, I'd like to maybe mix it up and use a different one. How many Judith Myers tombstones do you give it in quality?
A 3.
A 3.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell them your address. You're going to get some hate mail.
You don't know where I live.
I'm not going to do that. I kind of know where you live.
Yeah, but you don't know the address.
I don't know the number.
You don't.
I've never been inside your house.
Mm.
How scary?
Like a 2.5.
A 2.5.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised that you went that high. But although, sitting next to you, you jumped a couple times.
I saw
you jump.
I did. The thing is that what you said makes perfect sense. Listen, guys, I'm not trying to shit on this movie by no means. However, I'm 31 years old. I've seen a few horror movies and it's, I feel like if I had seen this movie the same time I'd seen something like The Ring or, Scream, it's one of those things, as you constantly hear me say, this is a movie of its time. If I was my age in 1978 watching this movie, this would scare the hell out of me. However, I am a desensitized, emotionalist millennial who has seen some shit, and this movie does not scare me because the things that I've seen are a lot scarier than what 1978. But still, I will give this movie, as far as credit and groundbreaking, I will give it 5 out of 5 Judith Tombstones because this movie is groundbreaking. What this movie did, what this movie created, what tropes that it started that became a parody and Scream, but still are basic rules to surviving a horror movie, I will never not give it the credit that it's due. John Carpenter started a whole subgenre of horror movies at
this
point.
Which you called your favorite ever genre.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. And I will give him credit, but I'm not going to sit here and just because it's the first, is it going to get the best highest number? But I will give him the credit. I will give the actors and the creative team the props that they deserve for doing something that had not been truly done. At this point, we have seen signs of the genre pop up with these, you know, these Jello films, with Psycho, with Texas Chainsaw. Like, we were there. And he finally took all of those tropes, sewed it in together, and gave us teen slasher horror movies. That man deserves so much fucking credit for it. And then from there, he built the foundation that the movies and the genre that I love have come to be. So yes, I will give credit where credit is due. As an older person watching this movie, it gave me jumps, but it didn't scare me. But I know if I'd have been a 6-year-old or a 9-year-old watching this, this would have scared me. Like, it would have scared the shit out of me. So that's my 2 cents on that is, yes, I'm going to give this movie the props that it deserves because it did it effectively. And like you said, it did it effectively with no blood.
Yeah.
Maybe
almost
a drop.
Almost
that is a thing that I think is phenomenal because then you have these movies that came out within the last 15 years where it's like almost torture porn. And it's like, okay, it's not even scary now. Now it's just ridiculous. It's almost like y'all just bought like 3 tons of blood and decided to just use it all. But the fact that he made things so suspenseful, and it is a psychological thriller. Like, I see so much of the Yellow films in this movie. And like I said, he built a foundation. The first movie of any type of genre is going to, because the thing is, it's almost like a generational thing. Parents always say, I want the next generation to do better. And to know that this was the first, and to know as an older millennial to see where the genre ends up is fucking phenomenal because it built such strong roots in this culture, in this subgenre, that I'm like, yes, I see the love of this film and all the movies that I love. I see it in Scream. I've seen it in Freddy Krueger. I've seen it in Jason. It's just in the fact that the thing, like you said, pops up 2 years later. So like I said, as a movie on itself, as a person from the first time I've seen it, yeah, I'm not going to give it as high. But for the cultural impact and the industry itself, it is 5 out of 5 because the roots are still there. This movie stands the test of time. It is the playbook on how to create an effective horror movie, how to create suspense, tie it all together, and to just give you something that is so simple, but it is so effective. And that's what I have to say about that.
Next week, American Psycho, because we promised it a few weeks ago. We're going to actually do it.
So from going to no blood to a lot.
Yep.
And Phil Collins. On that note. I'm Allegra Jade Fox.
I'm Michael Lewis Guzmano.
And this has been I Know What You Watched Last Sunday.
Sunday.
Or Saturday in this case.
Shut up.
Take care, America.